start moving on. All right. We know about temperature. We know about heat energy. In the next chapter, chapter 13, there's a discussion of the transfer of heat energy from one object to another or whatever. So, as an example of heat transfer, we have a pot sitting on a stove. Okay, and it's that water is heating up. So in order to get the water to heat up, of course, I need to put a metal pot on the stove. Okay, a wooden pot doesn't quite do it. Okay, so we put in different types of metal. You can put in aluminum pots. You can put in stainless steel pots. Pots have thick bottoms, thin bottoms, depending upon what you want to do. All right, so if you're boiling water, thin bottom pots should be fine, right? Because you get the heat to transfer quicker. But a thick pot, a thick bottom pot is much better for doing things like spaghetti sauce, so you don't tend to burn them quite as fast. Okay, so those are different types of things. So I've got a little stove here to indicate the different types of heat transfer we have. So the first thing I want to do is get the pot heated up. How do I get the pot heated up? I put it on a hot burner. Alright? So the heat is transferred from the hot burner through to the water, through the thickness of that particular bottom of the pot. This is known as heat conduction. Okay? So heat conduction is the transfer of heat from contact. Typically the idea is that we have heat on one side of the body and right, it wants to move through a wall or whatever, in this case, the bottom of the pot. So you can have either the bottom of the pot, or you could have, for example, heat transfer. I would say is the heat coming from outside into your cooled, air-conditioned room. Or the other way around, you could have your house heated up in the winter, and the heat is trying to get out, going into the cooler temperature. So typically we have two temperatures and we have heat flow. Okay, between these two different temperature regions. So we have a temperature difference. The greater the temperature difference, of course, the more heat energy will flow across there. So the question is, how much heat energy gets to flow across this barrier? Heat energy, as I've already mentioned, should be proportional to the change in the temperature. So that's one thing that it might depend upon, right? If there's a big temperature difference across here, the right, more heat will flow. What else could this possibly depend upon?
Material.
The material. Okay. Usually that's absorbed in some kind of constant. Okay. And so put a constant in there, call it K. K is called the thermal conductivity. One of those things you get to look up at a table, okay, depending upon the type of metal you're using in the case of pots, the type of walls that you're using, okay, whether your walls are insulated, etc. So whatever the heat's flowing across, whatever this medium is, okay, we need to know what it is and be able to figure out what its conductivity is. What else could it depend upon?
The distance that it is from the heat source.
Well, it could depend upon a couple of things, right? So if you think in terms of, say, walls, right? A thicker wall, would you expect that to affect things? Yeah, so the thicker the wall, would you expect more heat flow or less? Less. So we could talk about the thickness of the wall. The book uses the letter L for the thickness of the wall. But since it's less, the bigger the thickness, the less the heat, right? That'd be inversely proportional. So what else do we have? Turns out that if I'm interested in how much heat flows, we also need to know how big the wall is. So our wall could have a cross-sectional area. So the total heat flow across that area would be proportional to how big the area is. Okay, and so those are some of the main features. That's the heat flow. So if I take a look at the units here, we'll find that we quite don't have enough correct units here to have joules worth of heat. The other thing is, if I wait long enough, the heat will flow out, right? So you heat up your house in the wintertime, and you don't turn the furnace on, by the morning it's really cold, right? Because the heat continues to flow out of there. So we also need to put in the time. So little t is time, we're familiar with. This equation actually has two different t's in it. One's temperature and one's time. So this gives me the heat flow through the wall. All right, all I have to do is know the conductivity, the cross-sectional area of the wall, right, the temperature difference, how long the weight, and the thickness. So if we go back to my pot back here, right, we're thinking of the bottom of the pot. The thickness of the pot comes into play, the material, whether it's cast iron, stainless steel, or whatever. Okay, what other types of things can we call? How long do I leave it on the stove? The longer I leave it on the stove, the longer it comes. More heat energy goes in, therefore, more heat energy goes in. Q equals MC delta T, and I should end up with more change in temperature for the water. So, pretty much that's conductivity. That's one process. Another thing that goes on, so far what I've done is gotten the heat energy to go through the bottom of the pot to the water. Okay? But that's just the temperature down here. How does the water begin to heat up?
Through contact with the pot.
Well, one way you can do it is stir it. Right? What are you doing when you're stirring? You're moving the fluid around. All right, so there's another form of heat transfer called convection. This is the transfer of heat through the movement. In the case of convection, right, as long as the fluids are beginning to move around and whatnot, then they're going to move the heat energy around as well. Now, convection is one of those things that actually you should be happy about because it doesn't come with a formula. It's actually a fairly complicated process, convection. So we don't have a nice little formula for convection like we do for conduction. Though convection is fairly important, right? We have convection in the atmosphere. Right? Different parts of the atmosphere are heated up, and then we've got convection, and we've got winds and all sorts of things that provide us with our wonderful weather. Okay? So, convection is important there. There are convection ovens, right? Which convection ovens, right? You heat things up, but the convection oven manages to move around the air in there, and that'll have an effect on what you're cooking. So convection, let's see. So far I've gotten my water heated up. And then I take the pot off the stove and realize that I've left the burner on. How would I know if the burner were on? It's orange. It's not orange, I might not realize. If it weren't orange, how would I know?
It
would be hot. Of course, you wouldn't find out that it were hot by going in testing it with conduction through your fingers, right? Because we have really not intentionally put your finger hands on the burner. Right? How do you know? It's the heat energy is radiated from the burner. burner. So the third process is called radiation. Okay, energy is radiated from the burner. In fact, all bodies radiate. All right, given any body, okay, it will radiate. So if I have somebody sitting here, okay, physically, it gives off heat energy. You're sitting there radiating right now. Alright? Because you are at a non-zero temperature. Okay. So the amount of heat energy given off by any body, the radiant energy, turns out to be proportional to its temperature. Right? My burner. How do I get it to radiate more? Make it hotter. How do I make it hot? Well, some burners, it depends how they work, right? We're talking right now about an electric range, so I could easily do a gas range and talk about the radiant energy that's coming off the flames. But for the most part, how do I get this to radiate, right? We turn on some electricity, find out next session, semester, that if I push current through, okay, I can get electrical energy to give off heat, right? It's a resistor, right? Goes through the same kind of thing. But no matter how you do it, right, you've got that body giving off radiation, right? Different bodies will give off different colors when they're heated up hot enough, right? So we can look at the sun and other things. We can look at metals and see how they, what colors they are as they're heated up more and more. Okay, what else can we do? Well, we can do a lot of things. But we can't necessarily tell that the body is radiating by just sitting here, right? You're sitting here, you don't see the person next to you radiating in your vicinity, right? But we are radiating. We just can't necessarily see it in the visible range. Okay, so what does this depend upon? Well, you might have gotten some sense of what it depends upon from what I was saying. It depends on the temperature. Okay, it turns out that the heat energy here is proportional to the fourth power of the temperature. And so, this is the main idea. The radiant heat goes like the fourth power of the temperature. This is the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Now, you can't just put any old temperature in here. Okay? The temperature has to be in Kelvin. As we'll find out today, there are going to be many cases in which the temperature has to be Kelvin, not Celsius, as we've been dealing with so far. Okay, this is the first case where you would have to put that in. What else could this depend upon? Well, it also depends on the surface area of the stuff. So we have a surface area, right? So we look at the surface area of the object, right? Smaller surface areas at the same temperature are going to radiate less than substances with larger amounts. It also depends on, right? Again, we're talking about how much energy is coming out of this. It depends upon how long you wait. All right, so it also depends on the time. Okay, and it depends upon how good of a radiator the body is. Not all bodies will radiate the same way. So if sunlight hits your roof, right, you have black roofing tile on there, right? Then when it radiates that back off, it's getting hot feeling, right? Put white tiles up on the roof, it's not quite as hot. Right, walking on grass in the summer is not quite the same as walking on pavement. Okay. Or I guess even the beach, and it gets a little warm. But so it depends on the substance. So we need some type of a parameter, which we are going to call E, the emissivity. That parameter, if it is 1. Then we have a perfect radiator, okay, or what's known as a black body. So if E equals 1, have what's called a black body. Perfect. And I need to throw in some constant so that I can put equals. So there is a constant in here, sigma. This is the Stefan Boltzmann constant. And this constant's a fairly ugly one. So we get this is 5.67 times 10 to the minus 8. And then we have to put appropriate units. We want joules to come out. We need to divide by meters squared. We need to divide by Kelvin to the fourth. We need to divide by second. So that when I plug all these things in, all the units cancel, leaving me, of course, with joules. Remember, Q has units of joules, right, energy. All right, so that's just some ugly constant. Okay, you won't have to memorize that constant. All right, that'll come up too often. Okay, so a perfect radiator I put equal to 1. Okay, and this tells me how much energy is being radiated. So of course, the surroundings typically will radiate as well, right? Surroundings can be at a temperature. So surroundings can radiate towards the body. So not only do we have radiation going away from a body, we can also have that the body absorbs radiation from the outside. And so we're also talking instead of talking about emitting radiation, we could talk about absorbing radiation, which the same applies, except we would be absorbing it depending upon the outside temperature. Okay, so that's pretty much the radiation law. Now, very often, we don't talk about the energy radiated, but we just talk about things like the power, okay, or the amount of energy per time. Same thing back here. So when you look at problems, you may be asked questions like, what is the radiated power? First, that's where we have to go back and remember what is power. Remember what we did power a while back? Power, in general, is what? Energy per time. Right? Or work per time. Right? So power is how much energy per time. So in the case of radiation, if I were interested in how much energy per time, how could I get energy per time from this equation? Well, what's the energy? Q. What's time? T. So energy per time would be 2 over T. Alright, so you may be given so much energy per time, or you might have to find what's the energy per time. Or maybe they'll ask you, how much power is radiated per square meter? Okay? In which case then you would say, alright, well I'll just put A equal to 1 and I can get how much per square meter. Or I could divide Q by both T and A to give you the energy per time per square meter or per area. So those are questions which come up sometimes, okay, when being asked about these things. But for the most part, that's chapter 14. Right? You basically have three types of heat transfer, okay, given. And the conduction and the radiation just have a simple formula. All right. Again, the main feature for the radiation here is that the radiated power or the radiated energy in this formula go like the fourth degree of the temperature, and the temperature has to be converted to Kelvin. And, of course, we know how to convert to Kelvin, right? Take the Celsius temperature and add 273. At least the freeze big fix. Okay? Of course, we want to do a little bit more with thermal physics than just talk about the transfer of heat. We want to start looking more at how energy is being used, et cetera. Yes?
Does the conductor be thinking that in Kelvin as well?
No. No, this constant's given in terms of degrees C typically. Check in the tables. All right, this is the only place so far that we are required to put Kelvin. Okay? At least for the next 15 minutes. Okay? All right, so what we want to do is start thinking about thermal processes in general. Yes? So we want to start looking at things. Why? What happens when we heat things up, such as the air? All right? What happens when I heat up the room is that the molecules start moving around faster. All right? As molecules move around faster and faster, that means they each have more kinetic energy. So somehow the kinetic energy, on average, of a molecule is related to the temperature of the room or the temperature of the container containing it. Okay, solids are a little bit more difficult to study, okay, in terms of what's happening at the molecular level. So we typically turn to ideal gases. And that's what we're going to do in this next chapter, is we're going to look at ideal gases and look at some of the molecular behavior and try to understand something about the internal energy of a system. When we turn to chapter 15, we will use examples of ideal gases to study the relationship between the heat energy, the internal energy of the system, and other aspects of the system, like the pressure and the volume of the system. Right? When I heat up an object, right, will the volume increase, et cetera? Or, you know, maybe I can put a lid on it, and if I put a lid on it, the pressure will increase. So these are different types of things we want to look at. We're going to be looking at them in the context of thermodynamic systems. In this chapter, we're going to look at the ideal gas law in particular. And kinetic theory. As we will look at some of the results of heating up an ideal gas and the relationship to the internal energy of that particular gas. Before we even hit the ideal gas law, there are a couple of basics that we need. Okay, we need to be able to talk about, if I've got a container of gas, how much stuff do I have? But that also depends upon what it's made out of, right? If it's hydrogen gas or oxygen gas or whatever. So we need to define a few things. First off, we need an atomic mass unit. And we need different types of mass measurements. Typically, at the macroscopic level, when we measure things, we don't sit there and count the number of molecules. The number of molecules is important at times. So atomic mass unit, let's see. The atomic mass unit, which we will write as U for a unit, okay, can be defined by asking, or basically saying that if I have carbon 12, look at C12, okay, and specify the mass of C of, let's see, where am I going to go? Basically the mass of carbon 12 is exactly one unit, so okay, some places you see a mu per atomic mass unit, but in our text we're just going to be using U. So the atomic mass unit of carbon 12 is given by that. What is one unit? Okay, one unit is 1.66, let's see, it's just slightly different than 6605, that's left for what? 5 decimal places. I'm 10 to the minus 27 kilograms. So that's a relatively small unit. Okay, that's roughly the size of a proton. Okay, but that's specifically what an atomic mass unit is in terms of kilograms, so we can convert those things. Everything is based on C12, which is a fairly abundant isotope of carbon, and going from there, then we can talk about what the atomic mass units of other substances are. Well, actually, C12 is the following units. Let's see, what else? Other molecules. Typical molecules, I don't know, the usual one is water, H2O. Okay, what we have to do is actually go to a table and look these up, unless you remember them, which I found that people don't necessarily remember some of the basics, so typically I'll give some of these to you. But if I wanted to find out the atomic mass of one molecule of water, what you have to do is you go and figure out the atomic mass of hydrogen, which is 1, oxygen, 16. All right, so see, you know some of these. All right, but if we start throwing in carbon and a few of these others, maybe we'll have some problems later. All right, hydrogen. There's one atomic mass unit. There's two hydrogens, so you multiply by 2. One oxygen, which you said was 16. So a molecule of hydrogen is 18 atomic mass units. Okay, so that's relatively easy. You can look these up. Basically, oxygen is number 8 in the periodic table, right? That means you have 8 protons and about 8 neutrons. So that's where your 16 comes in. Right, protons and neutrons are approximately this. Actually, a proton is a little heavier than 1.6, like 1.67. Okay, but this works out that way because it's all based on the mass of carbon 12, except for some of these little differences in isotopes. All right, so that's okay, I guess, if you want to sit there and start counting how many molecules you have. But we've got to come up with better ways of doing this because obviously when you're in chemistry or wherever, right, you're not sitting there counting molecules. You didn't even see them, number one. Number two, people didn't even believe that much in molecules up until a little over 100 years ago. These molecular motion. Okay. We didn't even know that there was a nucleus until about 1912, 11. Okay, we didn't know it was an electron until about the late 1890s. Okay, neutrons weren't found out until 1932. Okay, so all this stuff that you've grown up knowing is actually historically relatively recent. All right, so you're there. I bet you've never seen a neutron, but you believe they exist, right? Okay, so anyway. So we need to come up with some other ideas as far as how to measure things. All right, so the next thing we'll introduce is a gram mole. Okay, 1 gram mole of a substance, okay, is basically the amount of substance that has the same number of molecules as 12 grams of C12. Alright, so 1 gram mole has the same number of molecules as 12 grams of C12. So somehow we got fixated on C12. Okay. All right, so now all I have to do is I get 12 grams of C12, go out and count the molecules, report back to you in a couple centuries, Okay. All right, same number, which is equal to 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. There's 6 times 10 to the 23rd molecules in a gram mole of C12. So, one doesn't always talk about gram moles, one talks about moles. All right, so we'll just drop the gram part. Okay. One mole of stuff has this many molecules. Don't confuse the word molecules with the shorthand mole. Right? Those are two different things. This has been given a name. We'll call it N sub A. It's Avogadro's number. So the idea that is if I have a mole of substance, it's got that many molecules. Okay? If I have 2 moles of substance, how many molecules does it have? 12 times 10 to the 23rd. If I've got 3, it's got 18. If I've got 1.5, if I know how many molecules of Avogadro's number I have, that, okay, will tell me how many moles I have. Right? So we can go backwards. So let n, little n, be the number of moles. Capital N is the number of molecules. Then the number of moles times Avogadro's numbers, right, is going to tell me how many molecules I have, right? So little n times Na is equal to big N. Or I could just find little n to be the total number of molecules I have divided by Avogadro's number. So there's a relationship between the number of molecules I have and how many moles I have. So little n is going to be the number of moles. Big N will be the number of molecules. They're quite different in concept as well as in size. All right? Big N is usually fairly large. So that's number. Okay, let's look at the mass of one water molecule. So let's ask, how big is a water molecule? Okay. All right, well, I need to know how much stuff I have. Okay. So let's see. First off, 1 mole of water. We've introduced the mole to be 12 grams of C12. Okay? Basically, 1 mole of a substance, you take a look at the atomic mass unit, for example, in the case of water, and you replace the atomic mass unit U with G. Right? So you write down, if I want to know what the mass is of a mole, I go ahead and write down the atomic mass and write it instead in grams instead of atomic mass unit. So write 18 grams. So 1 mole of a substance is going to be equal to the number of grams numerically equal to the atomic mass unit. Right? So in the case of water, it's 18. In the case of, say, O2, let's see, O is what? 16, 2, that's 32. So if I have oxygen gas, which is diatomic, means I have, right, can't just have the O by itself, an O2 type molecule, right, molecule, then 1 mole of O2 is 32 grams. Okay. So you just take the atomic mass unit, replace the U with the G, and that gives you the mass. So 1 mole of water is 18 grams. That's not what I want to know. What's the mass of 1 molecule, not 1 mole? So how many molecules are in a mole?
6.
So if I want to know the mass, okay, I can divide 18 grams by Avogadro's number. Now it's helpful to have a designation for the mass of 1 mole. So we write capital M, and we'll call this the molecular mass. So that's kind of strange. It should be the mole mass. All right, that's the mass of 1 mole. We take the mass of 1 mole divided by the number of molecules in a mole. The number of molecules in a mole is always Na. And that gives you the mass. So let's take that. That's 18 grams divided by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And what do we get? 2.9 times 10 to the negative 23rd. What are the units? Grams. And now this is what people usually just do. They usually forget to convert this when they're using this in other applications. Okay. How do I convert 2.9 times 10 to the minus 23 grams into kilograms? Divide by 1,000. So if I divide by 1,000, what does that do to my power? Subtract 3. So minus 23 minus 3, negative 26 kilograms. And very often we go a little further using the mass, and we would have to convert it to kilograms. Okay, so that just introduces a few things that we need. Number one, we need to talk about through the rest of chapter 14 and 15 things like the number of moles. At times we'll need Avogadro's number, and at times we will need the mass of one molecule. And so we have those relationships. But I said we were going to talk about ideal gases, right? So let's introduce ideal gas. Well, an ideal gas kind of hints that maybe the gas isn't real. Okay, it's an approximation. Okay, the gases. What we mean by ideal gases is that we have a gas that is fairly low density. If I have a very low density gas, then the molecules perhaps won't collide into each other too often. Okay? So if we have a population and there aren't too many people, right, chances of them running into each other, okay, is slim. So low density means we can neglect collisions between the molecules, right? We can neglect some of the interactions of molecules with each other. Okay, and so with under that assumption that we have a very low density gas, okay, and we don't have the collision and other things to take into account, then we can talk about the ideal gas in that sense. If we're not happy with the results, then we go back and look at our assumptions as usual and say, all right, well, what happens if I allow for a little bit of interaction? What if I also allow for the fact that maybe the molecules are not point molecules and they take up some volume? Right, in doing that, then there are other gas laws, such as the van der Waals law, which some of you may have seen in chemistry, which take into account some of those additional features, which, of course, are a little harder to pick up, you know, what is the effective size of a molecule, right, and all that. So those things we throw out the window for now, see how far we can get with just simple ideal gases, and then, of course, we can always compare that to real gases to see how far it'll affect us. All right, under the assumption of low density, all right, so then we wanted to talk about a few other characteristics of the gases. We're going to be talking about states of systems and things, and so the way to characterize a gas is, number one, how much stuff do I have? Okay, so let's see. The gas has a certain number of moles. And now that gas, I could put in a container, and it could occupy a certain volume. What other things could I throw in here? Let's see. Temperature. All right, so we can throw the temperature in there. And another characteristic is the pressure. These are macroscopic quantities. Okay, we could consider also the velocity of the molecules, but that is a microscopic quantity that we want to relate actually to some of these macroscopic quantities before the chapter's done. Okay. And that's where the kinetic theory comes in, into tying the velocity of molecules to things like the temperature. But right now, ideal gas. Well, people did experiments. This is long before they looked at molecular theory, right? You've got a container of gas. You can measure the pressure. You can measure the temperature, right? You can look at this. So what can you do? You can do some experiments and find out that, oh, well, you know, if I take a container and I keep that gas confined at a fixed volume, I raise the temperature, you find out the pressure goes up. Okay, so you do experiments, and so you find out that the pressure is proportional to the temperature. Or perhaps you put a little piston on top that, you know, you heat it up, and it pushes, right, a movable lid pushes it up as I'm heating it up, so the volume can change. So you can do all sorts of experiments, and in some places you may have even learned about some of these and found out there are things like Boyle's Law and Charles's Law and some of these other things that were discovered or named after these people until somebody finally put everything together and said there's a nice simple relationship. The pressure times the volume is proportional to the number of moles times temperature. In fact, there's a proportionality constant that we're going to throw in here. So this is the ideal gas law. R is the universal gas constant. And it's given by 8.31. We're going to see this often enough that I'm sure you remember this. And the units turn out to be joules per mole Kelvin. Kelvin. Guess what? This only works when the temperature is in Kelvin. Anything based on the ideal gas law from now on dictates that you have to use Kelvin. And we will see a lot of instances of this in these two chapters. All right, PV equals NRT. N, again, is the number of moles. T is the temperature in Kelvin. T is the pressure. What do you think the units would be for pressure? Not atmospheres, necessarily. Pascal. So if I actually solve this for P, right, you give me a volume and put it in cubic meters, bring it over here, put in the temperature in Kelvin, put in moles, P will end up in Pascals. Okay, so that is there. Now, there's also a molecular description of the ideal gas law. which comes up every once in a while, so we're going to throw that in the pot. Note, little n is the number of molecules divided by Avogadro's number. We saw that at the other end of the board. If I replace little n in this formula, we get PV is equal to, what's little n? Big N over NA R G.
That looks a little uglier, doesn't it?
But notice that R is a constant, NA is a constant. I'm going to replace those in, with a K. So we're going to write PV is NKT. This is a description at the molecular level where you know the number of molecules, not the number of moles. Okay, sometimes this is nice to use because it makes other formulae look simpler. What is K? K is R divided by NA. R is a constant, 8.31. NA is 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So if I plug those numbers in, we can see what we get. 8.31, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. So what do we get when we do that? 8 divided by 6, 1.38 times 10 to the 1.38. So 1 over 10 to the 23rd is 10 to the minus 23rd. Okay, and the units turn out to be just joules per Kelvin. This is called Boltzmann's constant. So again, that comes up quite often, the Boltzmann's constant. So we have two different ways we can write the ideal gas. Well, most of the time we're going to see it this way, but in some derivations this will be more useful to write things in terms of k's instead of r's. So we'll see that. So we have two constants. So we can do all sorts of things with the ideal gas law. Okay? As we'll see as we move on, I could give you R, C, and V, find T, as I just suggested. Okay, but very often you will see examples where they'll say, all right, I've got this container of stuff, ideal gas, okay, and I make some changes to the system. I could compress it, change the volume, right? I could change the pressure. And then ask things like, all right, after doing all that, what's the new temperature? Often you don't necessarily lose moles, right? Number of moles corresponds to having some molecules, right? The only way to get change the number of moles is to get rid of some molecules or add some more, right? So usually the prop to you do this where N is fixed. Okay, so we could have a simple example where we could start with an ideal gas at this is going to be quite a bit slow. Let's say 10 cubic meters of ideal gas. That's quite a bit of gas. 10 cubic meters, let's say it has a temperature of, say, 20 degrees C. And a pressure, let's say the pressure at 1 atm. Okay. The gas is compressed to say 2 cubic meters at 1.5 atmosphere. I'm just making up numbers so we could throw any numbers in you want. Question is,
what's its final temperature? So how do we do that? Okay. Essentially, you have two states. You have one state of the gas, which consists of the first parameters, 10 cubic meters, 20 degrees C in one atmosphere. And then you have a final state, which corresponds to that volume, pressure, and the unknown temperature. Okay. So what we have here, going back to the PV equals nRT, since P changes and V changes, T changes, we could rewrite that as PV over T is equal to what? NR. R is a constant. Assuming I haven't lost or gained any molecules, N is a constant. So this is constant. So PV over T is a constant, which means I can look at it when it's in state 1, compute PV over T, look at it when it's in state 2, compute PV over T, and they should be the same. Or another way to write this is that I label these variables with the state. All right, so P1, V1 over T1, and set that equal to P2, V2 over T2. All right, again, they should be constant because NR is fixed. Now you'll notice I've got six variables. I was given 5 of them. I can determine the last one. So very often you will see an application of the ideal gas law in that form. Okay, so where am I? All right. What do I want to find? The final temperature. Let's call that state 2. So I solve this for T2. I get T2. Bring the T2 up. Bring T1 to the other side, P1, V1 down, and we get the following. Let's see. Bring T2 up. I have P2, V2, and I'm going to bring down the P1 and the V1, and I'm left with T1. Very often you'll see it in terms of ratios of pressures or temperatures or volumes. And you just have to look at this. All right. Pressure 2 over pressure 1. Notice one of the pressure is one atmosphere, one's 1.5 atmospheres. I could convert those to pascals, but you know, it's just atmospheres over atmospheres. It doesn't matter if I convert or not. The ratio is the same, so I don't have to convert this. T2 is 1.5. T1 is 1.0. V2, what's the second volume? I ended up with 2. I started with 10. And then T1 is the temperature, and I started with 20 degrees C. But remember, where people mess up, temperature here has to be in Kelvin. So 20 degrees C is how much Kelvin? 293. All right, so what do I have? I've got 1/5. I get 90 something. 87.
Point
9. Oh. It's a 2 sig there.
Right.
88. Well, it's 87.9. Oh, I thought I heard 87.1. So it's 88. Okay, so 88 Kelvin, which is actually quite cold. Right. So that's pretty much how we do that. Okay, so let's see. Last comments. Preview of coming attractions. The next thing, and the final thing in this chapter that we're going to talk about is kinetic theory. Now, there's a nice derivation, which I'd love to do, but students give me weird looks when I do it.
Okay, it is in the book. The idea here is to describe the motion of the molecules and connect it with one of these variables, and we find out that the average kinetic energy of the molecule is related to the temperature of the gas. Okay? That is basically what the kinetic theory gives me. And then, if I know the average kinetic energy of each molecule, I can add up all of that energy these molecules have in the gas, and that's called the internal energy. We're going to make use of that internal energy in the next chapter. We'll also be starting tomorrow, and then take us through Friday. The next chapter, we are going to sit down and look at the relationship between internal energy, heat energy, okay, and how much work you have to do on a system. All right, these are going to lead us to the laws of thermodynamics. Climax of the week. Okay, I'll see you in lab.